Okay, Abundant Treasures is the name of this, because it's the name of a Buddha. We'll meet him later on in this talk. On these retreats, we've been looking at one of the pivots is a text for the last 3 years. So 2 years ago, we looked at Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara. So that's the text we get our Sevenfold Puja from. Last year, we looked at Dhammapada, series of talks and discussion groups, and this year we're doing the White Lotus Sutra. I think it was Dasani's suggestion, but we're going to completely off on another track, another type of text. And I was reflecting on this, and it might be a Western Protestant way of looking at it, but to look at the defining text of a tradition. You know, when we take the Dhammapada and go, this is the book of Buddhism, and traditional Buddhists sort of go, well, we've got lots of books, you know, but a Western one's the book. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency to see that. But we could see each of these texts as defining or crucial or cornerstone texts in the three main traditions of Asian Buddhism. So Bodhicharyavatara is a cornerstone of Indian Tibetan Buddhism. It's really important for Tibetan Buddhism. The Dhammapada is like maybe the definitive one volume text of the Theravadins, the southern Buddhism, what used to be called southern Buddhism. And the White Lotus Sutra comes into its own in eastern Buddhism, China and Japan. It's the important text there. So by sheer coincidence, we've covered the major traditions of Eastern Buddhism. Wee bit about the history. It appeared, this book appeared, in the 1st and 2nd century CE India. I was watching, I got the DVDs of Michael Wood's History of India. You know, I've seen that programme where he runs around, he gets so enthusiastic and excited about all different kinds of aspects of India. And he quotes Edwin Gibbons, talking about the 2nd century maybe being the happiest period in history. The West, the Roman Empire was at its peak. Pagan Europe was like at its strongest, most vital, the classical tradition. India was really flowering, China was really flowering. And in India as well, there was a real flowering of culture. The Buddhist culture sort of reaches its maturity about this time. So you've got, in a way, like, I suppose a collective mundane mind is catching up with the Buddha's vision. So you've got architecture developing, you've got big institutions, you start these big monasteries in North India. You've got myth, you've got philosophy, you've got drama, all things the Buddha didn't have time to do. Yeah, generations of followers afterwards just developed and developed and developed. And the White Lotus Sutra comes out of that. It's one of those texts that is a bit like a snowball. In there somewhere is a kernel, and it rolls through Buddhist chit-chat and Dharma discussion and everything, and it accumulates things to it. If you look at the whole book, you find about 5 chapters at the end that have just sort of joined in with the party and hung on and become adopted and been drawn into the main text. So that's where it fits in. It's part of a Mahayana. It's part of the second big phase of Indian Buddhism developing, in which in India itself, it was probably this type of Buddhism was always probably in the minority. There was a certain group of monks who were sort of going beyond the body of texts that were there, had a critique of established Buddhism that was going, had been going for 500 years, and moves into sort of adding on to that with these sutras, these texts developing and being held up. That's quite important because something like the White Lotus Sutra and texts beyond this category, they're not standalone. Yeah? You see sometimes in Japanese Buddhism, they try to make, especially this text, the whole of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist thought, Buddhist texts. But how it works and, and where it came from is it sits on top of basic Buddhism. I always quote, I don't think it still does, but Microsoft, is it Microsoft? Sits on top of MS-DOS, is that right? Help me here. Those computers better than me. You know, if you don't have the substratum, you don't have the thing on top. So you need your basic conditionality, three lakshanas, wheel of life, spiral path as we see it in the FWBO. You get real grips of all that, and then you can understand this text. Yeah. It's polemical, it's part of a historical argument. There's this argument. Even Mahayana is a bit saying we're better than what came before, we're better than the others. So you can imagine these monks who have the special texts, and there's all these monks who don't follow that and go, they're just deviating, they're following the wrong sutras, and they're arguing back, no, this is better than what you've got, and you are Hinayana, you're less, you're degenerate, you are following a smaller path, and this is bigger. When you read the text, you'll see this coming out, a certain argument. And it's also very important that we don't get caught up in the argument. Yeah? As Western Buddhists, we identify and we value the principles in what we find in Buddhism, but we don't get involved in the problems that they get into. We don't have to get involved in the history. Yeah? We don't have to get involved in the arguments over, you know, karma, which karma path, which big powerful Tibetan leader, which one's the real one? Because at the moment there's two rivals and they're having a fight and the lawyers are out sort of arguing over this. Is it $1.5 billion worth of real estate? We don't have to get involved in that. We can just go back to go, what are the principles in the Dharma? Yeah. The arguments you have, Zen tradition between sudden and gradual, that's not our argument, that's Chinese argument in Chinese culture. And this too, an Indian argument between the real Buddhism and what's not the real Buddhism and the new Buddhism and the bigger vision and everything. We dig into that and find common principles in it. With this sutra, rather than looking at it, talks about these three forms of enlightenment: Shravaka, Pratyeka Buddha, and Buddha. And we look at these in that tradition, it would be, this is a lesser form, this is a greater form, it's got a historical argument. But for us, we get to the principle of, we can have a narrow way of looking at practice, or we can have a bigger way. See that difference between this school versus that school, but get to the deeper principle that we can use and that we find useful. So the Lotus Sutra is a rogue sutra. It doesn't behave itself. Yeah. It doesn't fit into, one of the scholars have been reading, doesn't it? Quick points I've said. It doesn't fit into what came before. It's a critique of what came before. And it doesn't really fit into Mahayana proper either. It says dangerous things just to sort of stir up things a bit, yeah? So it's like, you know, you go into a party, something's a bit quiet, you want to noise it up. That's what the Mahayana Sutra is like, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a rogue, it's misbehaving. And it comes out with things just to sort of, it wants to get to the spirit of things. Whoever's behind this wants to get to the spirit. It's interesting. It's called a sutra, a discourse of the Buddha. But if you have a historical mind like we all do now, then you can't but see that it's later. You know? Mm-hmm. So like, maybe there's a kernel in there that comes from passed down orally from the time of the Buddha. But it's not literally the literal documented words that the Buddha himself spoke 2,500 years ago. It's like, it's coming from that same level of realization, same level of awakening. So in that sense, it comes from the level of awakening of the Buddha. You know? Traditionally though, this would be seen as being spoken by the Buddha. And all the arguments you'd see in traditional Japanese Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Indian Buddhism, you'll see this as actually spoken Buddha. We can't manage that. We sort of think, hang on, this has come down later on. Yeah. So a flowering, it's something that's come out of a big flowering, but rich period of Indian culture and Indian Buddhism. It's when things start to get written. It's very different flavours from the earlier texts, the Pali Canon. It's got this cadences of repetition that is an oral tradition. Yeah. It sort of sounds odd until you sing it. You know, it's like a ballad. Why are they repeating words over and over again? You know? But if you actually say it loud, it works. Yeah? This was written, it was designed, it evolved with people writing on the palm leaf manuscripts, you know, and building up these old texts. The oldest core of it, every chapter, if you look at the whole bit, it's got prose, and then it's got poetry, repeating the same story. And then it's got prose, and then it's got poetry. It's got prose, it's got poetry. You'll find this earlier on in the Pali Canon as well, but it's really developed in this text. And it's like the verses were first, and they're in the ordinary language, the kind of Prakrit, the kind of the spoken, not quite street language, sort of semi-polite, but not too posh. That's the oldest thing. And then when Buddhism got fancier, they translated, started to accumulate around the verses, which was an additional commentary or restating it in a different, what the verse contained in a different way, in classical Sanskrit. So this is Buddhism getting posh, it started to speak like I was speaking Latin or something, you know, speaking high Latin, and want to make things sound very fancy and very respectable. So you get this text being the different forms of Indian language. It survived, the original Sanskrit survived in Nepal, and there's little temples and monasteries. If you've ever been to Kathmandu, you get in little lanes under little low doors, and you find these ancient institutions. They're all married, and they're all kind of like communities of people living together, but they're descended from monks. This is some survivors of Indian Buddhism, yeah? And they've kept in there some ancient texts that go right back to old Buddhism. There's a version, I think it's an abbreviation, maybe not like ours, but a certain abbreviation, in Khotan, in the Silk Route. So you're getting up into Central Asia, these mysterious, quite fascinating kingdoms that used to exist in oases on this big route where silk went that way, and the Romans, the real struggle to try and sell things back to the Indians and the Chinese, but they would sell back glass. Glass would be taken, very precious glass, would be taken all the way across the desert on camels. And enormous rich cities developed. And Buddhism, whole forms of Buddhism, really flourished out there. We don't know so much about this. Koh Tan held out against the Muslims, I think first the Arabs, then the Turks. For 100 years, the king of Koh Tan sort of fought against it, been taken over. It gets into China. There's several translations. Kumarajiva is the famous translation. This is his translation to Chinese. Sangha actually says has got an effect on Eastern Buddhism like the King James Bible has on English-speaking world. Yeah. We're full of quotes from King James. And we throw in Shakespeare as well. But this text is important in China and in Japan. It's funny because it's, you know, these bands who... They never make it in Britain, they never make it in America, but their claim is they're big in Japan. You know? So this Lotus Sutra is, it's big in Japan. It doesn't seem to be all that important in India. It never really made a mark there. It definitely didn't make a mark in Tibet. It's there in the books. You read these big libraries in Tibet. It's tucked away up in the dusty corner. They hardly ever talk about it. But China and Japan, it gets there and it gets top of the charts. You know? And Kumarajiva's translation, somehow he gets the poetry right. And those refined cultured Chinese with the very high demands of what you're going to listen to and does this work, they go for it. Xie Yi, very important Chinese teacher, he focuses on the Lotus Sutra, and from him, all the schools of Chinese and Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, well, Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, really sort of focus on this. Dogen and Hakuin, major Japanese Zen teachers, the Lotus Sutra was very important for them. This is quite interesting. Modern Western Zen tends to, the way we treat Zen, it's like it's not about books, it's about experience. But the Zen tradition has a grounding in texts, and the Sutra, Lotus Sutra, is one of them. In fact, Dogen, someone was saying, one of the scholars I was reading was saying that with Dogen, all the bits that look like mumbo jumbo, we call, oh, that's so Zen. Yeah. If you read the Lotus Sutra, it makes sense. Yeah. Especially when Dogen starts bending space and time. And he's basing this on what you find in the Lotus Sutra. So Zen has a textual basis, same as all the other forms of Buddhism. These sutras are important as well to them. This is the name. Sadharma Pundarika, original Sanskrit name. So we tend to shorten it down to Pundarika Sutra, Lotus Sutra, White Lotus Sutra. But the whole thing is Sa, real, good, fine, Dharma, truth. So it's real good, fine truth, yeah? Or what's called the real thing? It's about that, yeah? It's the real thing. So it's definitely, it's having an argument, but somebody's not agreeing with it. It's an emphatic here, isn't it? Pundarika, Sanskrit has so many words for lotuses, isn't there? There's one for a blue lotus, I can't remember. Utpala? Yeah. There's one for, there's Padma. There's so many of them. Kamala, yeah. So this is put some of the Eskimos' words for snow. Sanskrit has so many words for lotus. Sutra, discourse of the Buddha, I've gone into that. It originally means thread. But if you see something in the Buddhist tradition as a sutra, it is taken as it's the highest authority. It goes back to the enlightened mind itself. So it's the communication from the enlightened mind, which is the real good, fine truth of the White Lotus. Mm-hmm. And it's Mahayana. It's the great way. The Mahayana emphasized it's not just enough to get enlightened yourself. What enlightenment is enlightenment, awakening for the sake of all beings whatsoever. It's Maha in terms of it's profound, it's really deep, it's vast and great in its depth. It's vast and great because it involves everybody. Every blade of grass is involved in your practice. You're doing it for every being. The different Mahayana sutras, there's scores and scores and scores of them. You could fill the room probably. The major ones, they're vast, they're big, they're like a loch. Yeah? You get this vast loch. And down the years, like many users come and take bits off it, don't they? Somebody takes a jug of the water and goes and mixes clay, and somebody else waters their garden with it, and somebody else waters cows, and somebody else mixes concrete. But the loch is still full. Yeah? The loch is never depleted. So it's like the White Lotus Sutra. You have a whole school of Japanese Buddhism, Nichiren Buddhism comes out of the Lotus Sutra. You have Bhante's book and talks. But, I've been finding ones on the net. Norman Fisher's got a series which is alarmingly the same as Bhante's. You've got on and on it goes. Thich Nhat Hanh's got a book. Whatever commentary you have on it never exhausts the sutra. It's like a great poem, you know, John Donne or Shakespeare or since one of Scotland, Dunbar or Henderson. You have centuries of criticism on it, but the criticism never exhausts, it never explains a poem, does it? You never explain a poem, no matter how long you talk, the poem's still beyond any explanation, it's still bigger. Same with the sutras, like it's never depleted. It's a door, yeah. I've been reading it, and just getting to a rather positive atmosphere. I was travelling up and down a lot to a hospital in Ayrshire to visit my mother who was in for 2 or 3 weeks. And just reading this sutra and just getting slowly transported into a different state of mind. I mean, you first come across the sutra, it's quite strange, it's quite different. I'll get into that in a minute. But what happened was something else happens. You go in through it into a bigger world, into a bigger perspective. It doesn't communicate facts. Yeah? There's not much teaching. There is lovely little bits, isn't it? There's one where someone who teaches this sutra should have the abode of the Buddha, the robe of the Buddha, and the seat of the Buddha. And it says that the abode of the Buddha is compassion, and the robe of the Buddha is gentleness and patience, and the seat of the Buddha is emptiness of all factors, emptiness of all experience. And it's quite profound. So there is teachings in there, but by and large, what it's doing is communicating a vision. Yeah, opening a door into a vision, into an environment, into a big mind. So I'm going to go through a bit about style, things I've noticed in style. First point, a Mahayana sutra is like a penguin. If you forget anything else, remember this. Yeah. You get a penguin, you see them walking about in land and it's really ungainly, isn't it? But then when you see them on film, in a David Attenborough programme or something, in the water, it's beautiful. Suddenly the penguin makes sense in its own element, which is in the water. So sutras like this, if we read it like a modern novel, in it like a normal narrative novel, we get bored, yeah? Because it doesn't work like that, it's not structured like that. If we read it like a textbook for information and facts, we'll get frustrated. It doesn't work like that, yeah? I was speaking with this in Vidyamaya, I said, well, maybe it's more like a magical realist novel. You know, these Latin American books were. Strange things appear and things break up. They're deliberately trying to break up this closed, settled, sorted narrative of normal time and space. Or like, what was it, postmodernist meta-narrative? Yeah, because it's constantly talking about itself. It's constantly
Haruki
saying...
Haruki Murakami, I'm thinking of.
A
Japanese writer, Haruki Murakami, he does it.
He's got it from the Lotus Sutra, then. Nobody in Japan that can read is probably not really familiar with this text, so that makes sense. And it's like, it's constantly referring to itself. And you're going, if you're used to reading books that we're used to in the modern age, that's confusing, isn't it? It's like, what are you talking about? You're it! And it's breaking up a self-enclosed, sorted world, and it's sort of starting to open out into something bigger, using those same techniques like the magic realists do, the postmodernists do. So what's its environment? Yeah, so the penguin is at home in the water. Where's the sutra at home? Two things where it's at home. Meditation. Yeah? As you go deeper into meditation, the language, the sutra, the way the sutra is written, what the sutra contains, starts to make more sense. There's vast spaces opening up. The Buddha shines light out from this point in his forehead, and it illuminates the universe out in this direction, and the whole world opens up. And you see all beings practicing the Dharma and doing this, and Buddha's teaching, and Buddha's passing into death, Parinirvana, and stupas being built. You see this whole world opening up. Meditation, you start to sort of move into that. Solids start opening up. Boundaries become permeable. You sit in that little hut out there sometimes. It was a buyer, wasn't it, one time in the shrine room? And sometimes in these retreats, you get quite quiet in your meditation. It's like the walls disappear and you're in the valley. Ever get that? And the size of the valley disappear. Things just, light starts to shine through. Or metta, where the whole world just turns into boundless light, these experiences. And the sutra's full of light. Flowers, just beautiful things. Things of beauty just shining, falling down. Fantastical beings, you'll get them in the meditation. Strange, wondrous things popping up. Space and time being bent. The ordinary world transformed into precious substances. Mahayana sutras love this. They sort of take a normal room and turn it into the seven precious substances, beryl and diamonds and jewels and gold and silver and moonstone, I think is one of them. The other world, their environment is at home in, is puja. Yeah? Devotion, colour, myth, image, incense, beauty again, jewels, precious substances, what pujas are full of that you're reciting. There's a Chinese teacher, a Chan teacher, the sort of original Zen Buddhism, Shen Yen, he's a modern writer, and he writes a lot of good books on Buddhism. He talks about the Chinese practice of upholding a sutra. And what he did in his training as young was he'd memorize text after text after text. His teacher would say, go and do the Heart Sutra, that's the beginning, go and memorize that, and then Diamond Sutra, and then the really big ones like the White Lotus Sutra, and he confesses that he could never manage it, there's too much to it. Yeah? But you would memorize it. You'd do this thing which is, you would prostrate. You'd have this ritual, it was more than one ritual, it would take weeks. You would sit there, you'd stand up, you'd say the first word of the sutra, which in English would be thus, and then you'd prostrate, reciting salutation to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that appear in the White Lotus Sutra. Then you'd go up and say, have. That's the second word of the sutra. And you'd do the same again. And you would do it all for all 80,000 Chinese characters in the sutra. And you'd copy out. I've put a copy of Tricycle Magazine, which has got a number of sutras, number of texts, number of articles on the Lotus Sutra. And they've got pictures in them, these beautiful illustrated kind of little paintings behind the picture, behind the text, and then a beautiful calligraphy done on top, people copying out the whole sutra in the most beautiful way. And we're not going to prostrate to every word in the Lotus Sutra, but what we're going to do is have readings. We're going to have a go at this, see the sutra in more its own environment. So before the pujas each night, we're going to have a chunk reading of the sutra. And try and get into that way of like the usual thing of like trying to grasp the meaning, get the useful bits out of it. So just being in the environment, just going a walk in a text, and just letting it wash over. This was abbreviated by Chittapala, this one that we've got, from the whole sutra. He took bits and edited it, and it was presented on an order day down in Manchester or Birmingham, was it? In which it took 3 hours to read it, and we all just sat in the room, and people would take turns reading, and went through the whole of this, reading it out. And it's like, first of all, I was going, I must pay attention, I must get it all in. And then I just go, you get bored with that, you can't take it all in. And you just hang out in it and let it wash over you, and you come and you go, and you come and you go, and it's like an artwork as an environment, yeah, rather than a lovely object I can possess and take hold and have sorted. Okay, more about style. Evoking abundance in two ways I'm going to go into. Numbers, yeah. The Lotus Sutra plays messes with our minds with numbers. Yeah, it loves this. There's a bit, I'll read this. So we're moving through the sutra, there's lots of lovely parables that we'll begin into the next few days. And then suddenly in front of the Buddha, a stupa of stupendous size and magnificence sprang up out of the earth and came to rest suspended in midair above the assembly. The stupa was 500 yojanas in height and 250 yojanas in width and depth. Now a yojana, this is Indian precision for you, is about the average distance a royal army can march in a day. It comes from the word to yoke. So you'd yoke up your bullock, you'd march it as far as it would go in a day, and then you'd unyoke it. And that was how long that was. And that's a bit vague, isn't it? But it became more precise. It's something like 8 miles. So 500 is 4,000 miles high, and 250 yojanas is 2,000 miles wide. So you've got this stupa, this thing, coming out of the ground this size. It was made of the 7 precious treasures of gold, silver, lapis lazuli, moonstone, agate, pearl and carnelian, being built with thousands of recesses, parapets and railings. It was splendidly adorned with countless canopies, streamers, flags, banners, all made with the 7 precious substances. It was hung with festoons of jewels, and myriads of jeweled bells were suspended from it. The exquisite fragrance of the rare Tamalapatra sandalwood emanated from it, pervading the whole world. So it's overloading you, yeah? It's overloading you with like, okay, think of a jewel, now here's some more, and here's some more, and here's some more. And then just when you've been knocked by that, you've been knocked by the smell as well. It's bringing in, it's multi-dimensional. And the numbers, yeah, it just loves to mess with numbers. Indian maths, I was watching a program on, me and Daphne were watching it on BBC4, and then see it, there was a mathematician going through history of mathematics, and there was a bit on India. And I was constantly got lost in this. He was trying to explain to me as simply as possible, and Leibniz and Fibonacci. I'm going, no, don't get it. That's not my field for mathematics. He's talking about Indian mathematics inventing nothing, inventing zero, and being really fascinated by zero and infinity and the relation between them. All the normal stuff that occupies a Western mind in between. There's something about this fascinating relation between infinity and zero was like the Indian mathematics crowning glory. And this sutra's about like this, yeah. It's either nothing or it's everything. It's absolutely everything. Incalculable thousands of myriads of millions of asamkhyas of time and space. So you get your calculator out and you go, right, what's a myriad? You want to add up and see how big this thing actually is. Until you come to asamkhya, which is just an inconceivable number, and you have to put your calculator away. And what it's doing is just trying to, it reminds me of Phil Spector. Phil Spector made this wall of sound, right? In fact, a lot of recording now, music does this quite a lot, but he really made his breakthrough of adding lots of bits to this to make a sweep in music, and it would just carry you away, wasn't it? The T-Doo produced Tina Turner's River Deep Mountain High. Right, that makes sense. And it's been stuck in my head ever since I asked people at breakfast. She's just singing about when I was a little girl and had a rag doll. Quite okay, it's nice enough. But you just get carried away. You go, oh, don't you? And it's like, it's because Phil Spector is messing with your mind and he's building up a note here, a noise there, building in things and building up this big structure that overwhelms you and sweeps you away, yeah? And gets stuck in your head for hours, yeah? Brian Wilson does it with Good Vibrations. I've got this in my iPod, you want to hear it as proof. He learned from Phil Spector and just built these things in order to sweep you, tilt you over. And the sutras try and do that with numbers. Yeah. So when you come across these big numbers, the literal mind, the mind it contains and makes it okay, has to go, and it gets completely replaced by just this expansion, this scale, this size. And as well as numbers, there's the other thing, which is image. The image is full of moving from poverty to abundance. Yeah. So you have somebody being poor, becoming rich. Somebody, a landscape that's dry, becomes lush and fertile. So a group of kids that are poisoned become healthy. Yeah. And lots of jewels. It's trying to move it with image and with Indian mathematics. It might not be our taste, isn't it? Adarsha, an odd member, he died recently, but he was... He grew up, one of his parents was Indian, one of his parents was Western, and he grew up in between the two countries, and he also put off with Mahayana sutras because it was a bit like what he called Punjabi bling. So someone gets rich in India, they make their second homes in these garish things, with everything shiny and chandeliers everywhere. So a Western taste might be not quite like this, but that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to just communicate this abundance, this soaring, sweeping effect. So the start of the sutra, it opens. At one time when the Buddha was staying at Rajagriha, the city of royal palaces, he assembled in Mount Gridrakuta a great multitude of leading bhikshus, in all 12,000. All were arhats, faultless, their outflows exhausted, never again subject to earthly kleshas. Their minds free, they attained what was to their advantage, being emancipated from all bonds of existence. Also assembled were 80,000 bodhisattvas, none of them ever regressing on the path to supreme perfect enlightenment. Describes them a bit. Present also were Indra, king of the gods, with his 20,000 sons, as well as the 8 Naga kings, 4 Kumnara kings, 4 Gandharva kings, 4 Asura kings, 4 Garuda kings, each with several hundreds of thousands of followers. And there was also King Ajatasattu, the son of Vaidehi, with several hundreds of thousands of followers. Each of these, after making obeisance before the Buddha, withdrew and took a seat to one side. Now, I've been in Vulture Peak, and it's the size of this room. So, a clue is, this Vulture Peak is not of this world. We're not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy. Yeah, another realm. Yeah. Just for the record, Indra's king of the gods, we know them, the Devas. A Naga is a great, powerful serpent being that lives under the ground. A Kimnara is a horse-headed banjo player. I've seen a picture of one of them in a Tibetan temple. The word means, what kind of man? Nara is man, and Kim is, what is that? Yeah. A Gandharva is a celestial musician. They're quite lovely. They're quite dainty little figures that fly. They're powerful as well, but they kind of fly in the air and they play music. You often get them dancing around the side of Buddhas and drawings and paintings. An Asura is like a god in a bad mood. It's a kind of anti-god who's fighting against the gods. Even they've turned up. A Garuda is a kind of part ego, part human, part something else, isn't it? Sort of, I was thinking of is it Brian Blessed and Hawkman, yeah, I couldn't help thinking of them in Flash Gordon. We're in that realm, we're in the realm of science fiction. Ajatasattu is, we're back to Earth now, he's the local king of the area. Yeah. And on it goes, you've got Yakshas as well later on, they're sort of forest beings, you know, living, really powerful beings that live in trees, like, not, well, Dryad's a western one, but not unrelated, sort of forest spirits. It's that spooky feel when you walk through the woods. You know, it's like, that's the start of a Yaksha. Yeah. Maharagas, Virocha and Neil are confused about that. I'd look it up. That's a giant serpent being god. So, not only are you not on in Kansas anymore, you're in a sort of a world of imagination, a world of myth, and they've all turned up as well. You've got the normal world we live in, which are the Saturn and his followers, and you've got all these extra beings as well, in other dimensions. So, it's science fiction, yeah, or magical realism without any of the realism. I'll have to read this. I don't know where it will fit in, but this is my Rilke poem about scale and size. Not be cut off, not through the slightest partition shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming. Yeah, so that's Rainer Maria Rilke. So, another thing about style is lots of parables, lots of stories. Yeah, it's not giving you concepts. There's very few concepts in it, and where they are, they're just added in to make it officially Buddhist. Yeah, what it's really working with is it's working with concrete images, and a concrete image is more experiential. It engages more of us than a concept, doesn't it? I just have to say, a burning house. You've all got a burning house in your head? Yeah, very rich, isn't it? You've got a particular burning house. You've got particular flames, yeah. Whereas you could say, like, you know, the impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness of conditioned existence. You got to work at that, haven't you? You got to unpack it. But a burning house is straight in. Yeah. A jewel sewn in a beggar's rag, hidden in a beggar's rag. Yeah. You've got that. It's very strong, very immediate, and it's working with these. So the next 3 days we'll be going through particular parables and kind of getting into them. So some themes. The most common refrain I found reading the text is we have gained something that we never had before. So Sariputra is the main monk, main follower of the Buddha, and the Buddha is telling him that there is more than what you've been practicing. I have been teaching you this so far in order that you can follow it, and he spends a lot of time explaining why he's done that, and here's more. And Sariputra and his friends, his people he's practicing with, say this: we have gained something that we've never had before. And there's a lovely phrase, it's one of my favourites in here. We are greatly delighted, we have gained what we never had before. Suddenly we've heard a teaching so rarely encountered, something that we never expected. We are profoundly fortunate to have gained great goodness and benefit, an immeasurably rare jewel, something unsought that came of itself. Is that, particularly that line affects me. Something that we never expected. That is a sign of growth. If you get what you expected, you're staying the same. But it's like you come into something new, you know, catch the rainbow, you have a meditation, you discover what Buddhism can offer, you meet somebody new, and you gain what you never expected. Yeah, it's something completely new. And this is a very cornerstone of thing. And Shariputra is moving. He's moving from the sense of what Buddhism is, from self-emancipation up to dedication for all beings. It's changing gear into this entirely new, entirely unexpected. And that is the heart of the Mahayana. And then what the Buddha teaches is the one vehicle. He teaches, like, there isn't all these little, this kind of enlightenment, that kind of enlightenment. There is this one vehicle. And this one vehicle is vast, isn't it? Let all be free of doubt and perplexity. World-honoured ones without exception teach this way. The one Buddha Yana, the one Buddha vehicle. For all Buddhas take the one vow. This is their vow. The Buddha way which I walk, I will universally cause all the living to attain the same way with me. Though Buddhas in future ages proclaim hundreds, thousands, kotis, another one of these enormous numbers, of countless ways into the doctrine, in reality there is but the one vehicle. Another theme, the world that the Buddha's in, and the teachings that the Buddha has, they're expanded beyond his imagination, but the Buddha gets expanded as well. Yeah. This is a bit big to get into properly in time we've got, but the Buddha who appears in the sutra isn't just the wandering individual that you would meet if you could go back in time 2,500 years ago in North India. It's not historical as we know it, yeah, but the principle of Buddhahood. In a way, who's talking is the ever-present potential of awakening. You find this in earlier Buddhism, in the Pali Canon. There's a talk on the Manchester site by Ratnaguna, on the Manchester website. It's about archetypal Buddha. Title is anyway. And he talks about this lovely image of, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it's the end of the Buddha's life in the Pali Canon. The Buddha describes himself as being old, and his body is broken, like an old cart held together with string, and Ananda's trying to give him a massage to release the pains in his back. So you're getting this aging being who's like just the suffering of the world is just worn down his body. Later on, a few pages later on, they're given, him and Ananda are given cloths of gold, just shining with lustre. I don't know if it's a bit like a lamy suit or something, gold, this beautiful shiny cloth, and they put it on Ananda. It looks really shiny on Ananda. They put it on the Buddha and it looks dull. To his skin. So there's these two sides of what the Buddha is. There's the human being practicing, working in the world, historical figure. And then it's what the Buddha really is. It makes him so different from the monk that was sitting next to him at breakfast time. Isn't it like this infinite, this radiant, golden being? Yeah. And it's that golden being that's speaking in this text. The word eternal never appears in the actual text, but it's used a lot in explaining it. But it's sort of... the Buddha is boundless. The Buddha is outside of time. Whenever in Buddhism you get words like eternal and primordial in terms of teaching or in terms of the Buddha, it's not eternal as in it continues through time the way that a god would. It's just not bounded by time. The whole distinction that we have, the whole narrow framework of time and space, enlightened mind is not contained by that. And the nearest we can get to that accurately is the word boundless, I think. So the Dhammapada says, him in whom there is not that entangling, embroiling craving to lead to any life, him the trackless Buddha of infinite range, by which way will you lead him? And the Lotus Sutra itself says, immeasurable are the world's heroes, that's the Buddhas, none amongst men, nor the world's heavenly creatures, that's the gods, can fathom the Buddhas. Yeah. So it's as if eternal, as if primordial, but just by being boundless. Time and space are forms of limitation, the ways we perceive, not the way reality is. Big theme in the text is, as I was saying earlier, expedient means, skillful means. Yeah. So the Buddha teaches according to needs. Yeah. The Dharma, reality, his vision of things, is inconceivable, it's boundless, but we can't understand it. Yeah. So the Buddha just does what Terry Pratchett calls lies to children, and just explains things in ways that we will understand. And this is Buddhism, in fact it's all of Buddhism, even the White Lotus Sutra. Yeah. But it's speaking things in very simple, vague terms in our language you can understand. But then the Lotus Sutra is the Buddha's opening up and telling a bigger context, yeah, a more open, more direct. Temporary measures. You can see the whole of the Dharma as temporary measures. And then my favourite theme is all who practice are on the path. Yeah. Here's a quote from it. In fact, it's not from Chittapala's. He's left this out. He's left my favourite bit out of this abbreviation. I must complain. But here's a bit. Or even if little children at play should collect sand to make a Buddha stupa, then persons such as these have all attained the Buddha way. Even if little children in play should use a piece of grass or wood or brush or perhaps a fingernail to draw an image of the Buddha, such persons as these, bit by bit, pile up merit and will become fully endowed with a mind of great compassion. They have all attained the Buddha way. So this is it. Yeah. What is it? Well, Mogavira used to give a talk called Game on, way to go. So the game is on, we are practicing. Yeah. It's not a rehearsal, it has begun. That's what, in Buddhist terms, what it's meant by all this be here now is like, do it, this is it, it has started. Yeah. This is very heartening, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, we are doing it, yeah? It is working. And if we keep on, enlightenment is guaranteed. My favourite quote, isn't it, is the Buddha Dharma belongs to those who persevere. Mm-hmm. That's what a mitra ceremony is, in a way. It's like, that's what I always say in a mitra ceremony is, this is as Buddhist as it gets. Somebody going up to the shrine, going up to the embodiment of their ideal, and offering flower, incense, candle. That's it. Yeah. No matter if high hedians or secret empowerments can get any more Buddhist than just making a move towards the Buddha, making a move towards living out a bit more of this ideal. And the sutra's full of this. It's full of predictions of enlightenment, page after page after page of these monks have been practicing the way their limited teachings, been told, here's a lot more to go, and you're going to do it, and I can see you becoming enlightened. The Buddha's telling them all that. So it's begun. It's not a rehearsal. This is very challenging as well. Here's a poem. Coleman Barks' translation of A Bit of Rumi. These spiritual window shoppers. These spiritual window shoppers who idly ask, how much is that? Oh, I'm just looking. They handle 100 items and put them down. Shadows with no capital. What is spent in love and two eyes wet with weeping? But these walk into a shop and their whole lives pass suddenly in that moment, in that shop. Where did you go? Oh, nowhere. What did you have to eat? Nothing much. Even if you don't know what you want, buy something to be part of the exchanging flow. Start a huge foolish project like Noah. It makes absolutely no difference what people think of you. So they handle 100 items and put them down, shadows with no capital. So this is it, we're on. We're as bruised as it gets, just get more so. Next, no lost causes. I love this too. This is another bit of my favourite bits that Chittavala's left out of the abbreviation. The chapter 12, Devadatta chapter. Devadatta is the really bad guy who tries to kill the Buddha again and again. He falls out with him and tries to destroy him. But of course, the Buddha outdoes him. And there's a lovely bit of drama goes through a lot of Buddhist texts. Well, in this chapter, the Buddha describes Devadatta becoming enlightened and being great friends in the past and helping each other. So it's like even the baddest guy in Buddhism is going to get enlightened too. Yeah, there's no lost causes. And then straight on after that is my very, very favourite image of an 8-year-old dragon girl. I'd love to get someone to draw a manga comic version of this. So at one point, Manjigosha, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, rises up out of the ocean, and someone says, where have you been then? And he says, I've been down in the Nagas. These miraculous beings that live deep in the earth, deep underwater. They're serpent beings, they're sort of the powers of nature. They're also, probably in Indian culture, they've got to do with the tribal peoples who are outside of being civilized. So an Indian person would naturally see the Naga Vangs rather than the Surya Vangs. So we see the barbarians and being very uncivilized and very posh Buddhists would say, well, they're not very good for Buddhism. But here's one turns up, 8 years old, and Manjigosha says, this is my best pupil. Yeah, this 8-year old, so a girl, which in Indian Buddhism is pretty down, a child, and somebody who's not even human. In fact, in the monastic rules, before you're ordained, you're asked, you know, are you a man? Are you this? Are you that? Are you a naga? Are you a serpent being in disguise? It's a literal question. If you are, you're out. But she's in. She's the best pupil of the Bodhisattva wisdom. And Shariputra is going, my goodness, he's staring open-jawed. And she goes, look at this. And pulls out a jewel worth the whole universe and offers it to the Buddha. Yeah, offers to the Buddha very quickly. So usually merit takes an enormous amount of time to build up capital to give. She just does it instantly. And Shariputra goes, that was very quick. And she goes, watch this. And she turns into a Bodhisattva, becomes a Buddha and starts teaching instantly. And Shariputra goes, oh, that's not right. It took the Buddha aeons to become that. Yeah. And there's still got this manga drawing in my head of this girl. The jewel, of course, it's not literally the whole universe. It is when you're wholehearted, when you're completely with something, that is the universe. When you're completely there, that is your whole world. Yeah? And she offers that. She offers completely her world, herself, and the whole embodied in the whole universe. That's my favourite bit. So it's unpredictable truth. It's the rogue sutra misbehaving again. Yeah? All these terms such as you have to practice this long, you have to do this, you have to do that. Yeah? People are unpredictable. The sutra is being unpredictable because reality is unpredictable. People are unpredictable. And it's telling us never underestimate anybody. Breaking down more boundaries. Yeah? So, another big theme, getting near the end, the walkout. Yeah? Shariputra persuades the Buddha at the start to explain this higher truth. So he's sitting in deep meditation. Somebody has to ask the Bodhisattva wisdom what's going on. He says he's about to teach the Lotus Sutra. And the Buddha says, this is beyond, and nobody can comprehend this. This will just upset people. And Shariputra goes, no, you must teach it. And the Buddha goes, but it will have such consequences. People will react to it. And he goes, no, you must teach it. And he says it three times. And if you ask the Buddha something three times, he just gives you. If he's got bad news for you and you ask him three times, you're going to get it. Yeah? And it happens again and again. So he does that. And he says, but now the Buddha will reveal the mysterious, incomprehensible, profound, subtle, and wonderful Dharma, the perfect truth in full. And just as he's about to start, 5,000 walk out. Monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, the lot, they all just got out. Yeah, because the sutra says, the haughty spirits so enlarged that they imagined they had attained and understood what in fact they had not. So it's the other side. The sutra's given talk about this boundless potential for a fuller life, a fuller understanding, a bigger vision. And the other side is how we limit that, how we close that. Yeah. The limits we draw. We think we know it. As any spiritual tradition will tell you, you know, when you think you know it, you've lost it. Yeah. We mistake the partial that we've grasped for the complete that we'll never grasp in a way. We refuse to be open to anything beyond ourselves, isn't it? We go through life with a kind of me-shaped pastry cutter, don't we? Make it, you know, that film, John Malkovich, isn't it, where he goes into himself, his own head, if you have to know the film, and the whole world's got John Malkovich faces on it. It's really spooky. Even dogs got John Malkovich. If you know this, you know it, yeah. It's the scariest bit of film in the world. It's like the whole world is me and me shaped, and it's all about me. You know? Fundamentalism is about this. I've got it. This is it. This is the book, the good book. And you can just shut off anything beyond that. Literalism. Yeah? Flat earth mentality. Taking something literally, flatly. That's about this. Or poor old Popeye, isn't it? I am what I am, which might be good for Popeye, but not very good for practicing spiritually. So we shut off the potential of the Dharma, yeah? And therefore we shut off the potential of life. Because Dharma is the way to life as it is, the way to life as it is lived fully. And what happens is when these people walk out, it's like they've got it, they want no more. Yeah? And that's why in the sutra, a Western mind looks a lot at the stuff of what happens if you criticise the sutra. I've been thinking about this and I react to it and go, oh, this is blasphemy, I've got it at last, here's Buddhist blasphemy. But the sutra is a gateway into the Dharma, into this constant expansion, into growth itself, which is life itself lived openly. If you shut off growth, if you shut off life, then you suffer. It's just a lovely graphic way of describing what happens when you shut off. It's not like, ah, you're blaspheming against the Lotus Sutra, you're going to hell. It's like you've shut off from life itself, and that is suffering. It's just put a very colourful way. So, my 26 years at the GBC, doing endless classes and seeing people stop them coming. The meditation class is good for this because by week 3 or 4 you start introducing the metta bhavana and usually the numbers go down. Yeah. It's like, whoa! It's like, be in touch with how you actually feel. Yeah, valuing yourself. That's the hardest thing, isn't it? Valuing others. Yeah. Valuing your enemy. You don't have to like them. You don't have to approve of them, you know. And it's like you see people almost literally going. I think one poor lassie in the last one ran out the door. Yeah. But it's like it's beyond calm, isn't it? It's beyond that lovely little picture of the blue sky in the head and making you stop thinking. It's like you're going deeper into life, not escaping from it. Mm. Yeah. So it's something you're not looking for. Yeah. It's something which you did not expect, and your response is shut, closed down. And shutting down is not bad in itself. I mean, all these things, the limited reasons you want from the Dharma is not bad in itself, but is limited. So it's three ways, I'm just going to finish with this, three ways that we can, I've seen, like we can shut down three of my favourite themes, and then I'll go through points of discussion, we'll have a tea break, points of reflection discussion, and we could use these points I've written up for reflecting on and discussing. So here they are, here's my three favourite, and they're tying in with ethics, meditation and wisdom, or action, meditation and view, as the Tibetans would put it, they put it the other way around, but here we go. So action, ethics. It isn't about being bad, it's just about limiting our action or behaviour and taking Buddhism in the terms of just going it alone, doing it, leaving out the collective dimension of practice, you know, leaving out Sangha. So I'm on retreat here, so I'm preaching to the converted, because people who do it alone haven't turned up. You all are joining in with others, so it's probably redundant this whole bit, but never mind, I'll do it anyway. And it's very easy these days to be isolated, isn't it? We can buy books, we can watch things, listen to things online. We don't think we have to meet up with actual other people. And we can kind of have a sort of practice unrelated to other actual people. So there's three important ways that we relate. Buddhism as a full practice relates directly with three other sorts of people to make a practice complete. So one is relating to teachers. So looking to actual experienced practitioners, yeah, and being open to learning from them. The contemporary mind doesn't like that too much, isn't it? It's like, I'm doing it myself. So it's like having that sort of somebody who has more experience in the practice and learning from them. Very important rider with that is you choose. Beware of anybody that's got tells all their credentials and goes, you must follow me. Right? That's a cue for going out the other door. But you choose somebody. You think it's you, and you have that receptivity to learning from them. It's not up to them to be chosen. Next one is peers. Yeah, this is the effluvial strength, is the connection we have between others as just other practitioners. Yeah. Friendship, mutual support, working together in our practice. And then outwards to less experienced, to sort of doing our bit. Given our ability and given our available resources that we have, it's not like we should do so many classes and this should happen and that should happen. It's like we find our own way, our own style, our own ability, and within our limitations and commitments that we have, but to help communicate the Dharma to others, you know, to express compassion and to give this abundance that we've got a taste of to the world. And it's not an option, you know, it's part of our ordination in the FWBO, so we've actually explicitly taken this on. If we're ordained, we've taken on these as commitments. And if we've asked for ordination, we've asked to take it on. And for interest in ordination, we're interested in asking to take it on. Because at our public ordination, we take three vows, acceptance vows. So we say, for the attainment of enlightenment, we accept this ordination. We're doing this practice, we're doing this, being in the order to gain enlightenment. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. That's the first one. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. That's the second group. And for benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So it's right at the heart of what makes the WBO and what makes the FWBO. So practice, that's kind of like ethics or action. It's a way of relating. We've been living in the world and relating in the world. This is our meditation, our practice. So this is limiting our Buddhism to just one technique, which is usually in the modern age just meditation on its own. You have people who just want to learn meditation and the rest is like, they do a select, this pick and mix, have this please thank you, and take it away. Christopher Titmus talks about, he's come from the Vipassana tradition, so he's been a bit cheeky towards his own lot, and he's saying so many Buddhists have this one-fold path of mindfulness. So you have the Eightfold Path, which is a full comprehensive bundle of how to live a full Buddhist life, and a lot nowadays people go, I have just the mindfulness one. Yeah, it's number 7. And you get this, people engage with just meditation, they tend to have a limited shelf life in their practice, it tends to die off. And even the meditation doesn't work after a while. A number of people I speak who have quite a simple, narrow approach to meditation, not even mindfulness meditation, just quite a narrow approach to certain kind of practice. And they quite often say, like, not much is happening, I've lost the edge, not much is going on anymore, it's getting a bit dull and a bit boring. So you need puja, you need work for the Dharma, you need study, you need spiritual friends, you need talk about the Dharma. Yeah. It's a bit like if you have the broader your band on your computer connection with the internet, the faster the connection, the faster the pages come up. So like the broader, the more your life's engaged with practice, the deeper you'll go, the more inspired you'll be, the more you'll be engaged, you'll be opening into the abundant treasures, rather than trying to squeeze the whole world through the tiny hole. An image stuck in my head of seeing the whole world through the hole in your sock, it's a nice image, but it's not quite relevant. Yeah. Your broadband, faster connection, remember that, but that's fine. Third thing, views. Yeah. So once, about 20, 30 years ago, there was more bringing a particular view to the Dharma, rather than seeing the Dharma as itself. It used to be generally kind of religious comparison. So you'd have a Christian view of Buddhism, or this kind of view of Buddhism, or that kind of view of Buddhism. Nowadays that's much less. There's much less religion in society. It's usually materialist, isn't it? It's just like we live in a world where it's just this sensory experience and just this immediate lower mind. And this limits meditation. I've been thinking recently why we're less and less talk and less people experiencing dhyana practice, deeper meditative states. And I think it's because we've got a view which excludes higher states of mind. It excludes traditional religions are always talking about God realms and heaven realms and vast universes up there. And with that kind of mind, it's quite easy to sit down in meditation and you know that you're in a world that's much bigger than this particular experience, and you open up into the dhyanas, which in Buddhism is a subjective experience of heavenly states. Yeah. I was thinking like a traditional Christian could probably get into deeper meditation states better than a materialist Buddhist because they've got all these pictures of angels and heavens and lovely higher realms. Yeah. I was also thinking of Aleister Crowley and his friend Alan Bennett. They went out and they practiced in Ceylon in Burma. Alan Bennett became the first British Buddhist monk. And they came back and set up one of the first Buddhist practice communities in London. But they were practicing away, and Crowley's describing these really deep meditative states. And I thought, but he's a complete rotter, complete unethical cad, you know? And he's getting into really deep mental states. And I thought, well, they've been trained in what was called the Order of the Golden Dawn, in which, one, they learnt discipline. They learnt to practice thoroughly, whatever they were doing, the rituals, and they also learned a worldview, it was Kabbalah, real Kabbalah, not your Madonna stuff, but of higher and higher realms, which is 10 realms, and you're just down at the lowest number one. Material world is the lowest one. So they've got this whole context, this whole set of views, way beyond this physical material world, and they've got a discipline to focus. So they sit down, and bingo, concentration. So, and the sutra will bring this out. If we've got reactions to devas, maharagas, kimnaras, gandharvas, yakshas, all these lovely things, it'll come out and we'll be able to see where, like, this is not my view, this is beyond my limits. And the sutra will draw that out. So it can be interesting to think about this. So it's not about not having limits, yeah? That's unrealistic. It's like, I don't feel limits, I don't have limits, I'm okay. We'll just come a cropper with that. It's like, it's being aware of our limits and being aware that the world is bigger than that. That the Dharma is bigger than that. Yeah. It's about having an attitude to limits in context, a much bigger picture. It's about seeing beyond that and seeing my limits and the bigger picture. It's about allowing the call of the Lotus Sutra. It's about hearing the call of growth, of life itself. Yeah. It's about being receptive to the abundant treasures that I've been talking about, yeah? To something that we never expected, to gaining something that we never had before. To gaining something that the Dharma has to offer, and to gaining something that life has to offer.